Hey, welcome to another Port Tape Psychedelic Podcast. We have a recording that we made a while back with Larry Norris, the amazing founder of Decriminalized Nature, and it's one of our favorite talks we've ever done. So sit back, relax, and have me and Sebastian talk with Larry, PhD, co-founder of Eerie, Entheogenic Research, Integration and Education, and Decriminalize Nature. In some parts of the USA, it's actually illegal to even look at a psychedelic plant or mushroom grow. And of course, you have to be mindful and careful using psychedelics. They're not for everybody. But in a time when we're uncovering such remarkable potential of these plants, people that are using them for depression, PTSD, or suicidal thoughts are still being punished for turning to nature for healing. Plants that have been used legally for centuries in cultures worldwide, but now you're thrown into jail because of the war on drugs. Larry has made it his life's work to educate communities, advance research, and drive grassroots legislative efforts to decriminalize entheogenic plants and fungi. In our opinion, his work and contributions are invaluable to a movement that is rethinking how society interacts with these sacred tools. In this conversation, we explore what it truly means to decriminalize nature and not legalize, which is something different. So what is the difference? We delve into the strategies and the reasons for decriminalizing versus doing other things. We also have the challenges behind reforming policies and where are we now in the process. And you'll also hear about inspiring stories of individuals who have found profound healing from conditions like PTSD or trauma through these plants and still face legal consequences speaking out to local governments about them. At Porche, we deeply admire Larry and the work of Decriminalized Nature. And as a brand rooted in the psychedelic space, with our carefully crafted altar boxes, our integration journals, and our beautiful stash cases, we honor Decriminalized Nature, and part of our proceeds go directly to their work, helping to fund vital advocacy research and education efforts. You can more learn about our offerings at porchesupplies.com. We have a discount going on. You will see it on the website, or you can email us at hello@porchesupplies.com for a discount. Please check out our boxes. And if you believe in the cause of Decriminalized Nature, go to decriminalizednature.org and consider setting up a regular donation. Movements like this are powerful by community support, and the work being done is nothing short of transformative. Thank you for tuning in. Thank you for supporting our missions. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not constitute medical, legal, or professional advice. Psychedelics are powerful substances that should always be approached responsibly and with proper education. They should not be taken lightly as they can cause adverse effects, especially without the right preparation, setting, and support. Please consult with a qualified professional before making any decisions regarding their use, and always follow the local laws in your area. We make these podcasts outside of our regular work, so really consider going to our website, porchesupplies.org and decriminalizednature.org. Thank you so much and enjoy this podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you very much for having me. And, you know, first and foremost, I'd like to say it's always more fun to talk to the super psychonaut crowd in many ways, because we don't have to sort of tiptoe around some of the basics. You know, we can kind of dig into it a little deeper. Especially because I'm very fascinated by the inner experience as well, and where these places we're going to, and what does this mean about consciousness and religion and spirituality and mental health and, you know, beingness and all that stuff. So nature, reality, all these questions come up when you start diving into these deeper layers that a super psychonaut to kind of be familiar with. So really appreciate that. So hello, audience out there. Hope this is a good conversation for y'all. For Decriminalized Nature, you know, this is something that, you know, just like you said, it's a statement as well as an action, right? And the statement was really like, are we going to help people realize how absurd it is that there are certain things that are against the law that could randomly pop up in your yard and you can get arrested for it? A mushroom could randomly pop up in someone's, you know, yard or somewhere where they're at, and all of a sudden, or they take it out of the ground, they don't realize it, and all of a sudden they're criminalized. Like, how is this possible, right?
Yeah, we're so used to that phenomenon, right? But well, I have to snap out of this. Like, yeah, that's completely absurd. Somehow we're just born into this. Like, that's a possibility, but it hasn't been for thousands of years. Right? But it's kind of mind shift.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And what it suggests is that there's a power dynamic that is controlling of how you can be a sovereign being on this planet, how you can connect with nature, how you can engage with what it is to be a human being. You know, I think these are all really important questions. And when you have these sort of walls saying you can't access this thing that is just naturally occurring, you know, potentially in your backyard or in the forest or what have you, or can grow really easily, then that becomes problematic. And so we really want to sort of tap into that ridiculousness, because automatically, even city council members, people that, you know, are maybe not even for what we're up to, when they hear that, it makes them pause and think, wait a second, how is nature illegal? What does that even mean, right? So that was a big part. Secondly, we really wanted to hone into the dynamic at play between decriminalization and legalization. And a lot of people, even myself included and other policy people, that's a fuzzy area for folks. They assume that decriminalization means legalization and vice versa. Let's just legalize everything. What they don't often think about is the fact that legalization requires a framework of good and bad, licit and illicit, right? As soon as you create a legal market, you've created a structure, you've created this person has to get a license, they're going to do these things, they're going to blah, 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 they're going to have all these things set up. And if you're outside of that system, or if you don't pay the government their fee, then you're illegal again. So there's a couple groups out there that have called this prohibition light. You know, it's okay within this very small boundary, but outside of that boundary, you're still illegal. So as long as you beg for permission from the government, you can have access to something you should have access to anyway. So decriminalization is saying, let's remove those criminal penalties, or maybe even further in safety scheduling, let's get it off the Controlled Substances Act. There's no reason for plants and mushrooms to be on, this is why we have for Controlled Substances Act, period. But plants and mushrooms specifically, because again, they grow out of the ground and they're nasty, right? So this really sort of allowed us to have this sort of deeper conversation around, how do we talk about these things? Is it okay for someone to grow their own? Do we have to be dependent upon a pharmaceutical company? Do we have to be dependent upon somebody else to sell us back what grows naturally in the ground and we can grow, you know? And this, you know, then can take into, I've seen some people, you know, rightly so, even, you know, for us, we've kind of been like, oh, well, we're focusing mostly on entheogens and psychedelics, the natural plant kingdom and muscle kingdom. But there are also people who are like, hey, what about raw milk or collecting rainwater or all these other things that were also regulated and not allowed to do here? At
least collecting rainwater.
There's places in the United States where that's illegal, right? Why?
No way.
No. So these are these. Yeah, exactly. So this is the removal of humanity from nature, which if we look at what's the core issues around most of our mental health issues, that could be one of those things. So when we start looking at mental health and other things, there's so much complexity. And that's what we're trying to tap into with this name as well, around this decriminalization, legalization thing. Now when we get into nature, this allows us also not just be talking about one plant. You know, when we started off, it was Denver. Was looking at passing in Colorado. They hadn't done their ballot initiative yet. And then Oregon was talking about it. And Denver was talking about decriminalization through a ballot initiative. Oregon was talking about a legalization approach. Denver and Oregon both were only just looking at mushrooms or psilocybin, right? And so we said, we're in the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. You know, there's all different communities here. We have the Iboga community. We have the ayahuasca community, we have the DMT community, we have the cacti community, we have the mushroom community. Like, why do we want to just do one thing at a time, right? And separate us out and continue that process of reduction to this one single thing, when we're saying, what we're really trying to do is have a bigger conversation around nature. What is our relationship with nature? What are our ancestral practices across the planet? Everyone I work with plants and mushrooms medicinally in some sort of way, whether it's psychoactive or not psychoactive. And so how can we get back to this conversation around nature? And that had a big effect, because now it wasn't like, hey, you guys are just trying to get high off these mushrooms. It was like, hey, how come these are illegal? How come we can't access these? How come we can't learn about these plants? So I can't even watch, you know, a mushroom grow or a peyote button grow. Just even watching it grow. If I don't do anything, just watching it grow in California, if I have it in a pot or something, that's illegal. You know, like, what am I doing? What's what's going on here? Why is that illegal? So it's just kind of hammering away at these very, very, very fundamental issues around what is our relationship with the world and what is our sovereignty or self-agency around our own healing process. That's a little bit of a confounding variable. You know, we become so dependent upon other people for our healing process, then we're able to actually do our own healing process. You know, that in and of itself is healing. You know, that's empowering. And so we're trying to bring all that together. So decriminalized nature was really to encapsulate the process, decriminalization versus legalization, and what we're talking about, natural versus, you know, other things versus, you know, having a bigger conversation around nature and ancestral practices and that type of thing. Oftentimes, as you probably know, we use the word entheogen a lot. sort of contrast to psychedelic, not that there's anything wrong with psychedelic, but, you know, there's a group of anthropologists in the late 70s that came up with the term entheogen, which basically means generating the divine within. Now there's a whole other side to that as well, but they came up with it because at some point in time, talking about an ayahuasca ceremony and calling it psychedelic, was a little dismissive of this long practice of ayahuasca ceremonies that have nothing to do with the 60s and 70s countercultural movement in San Francisco Bay Area, which is kind of what we think about, or psychedelic music or psychedelic art as a particular style, particular vibe, right? And that wasn't really like working, overlapping so well for being able to describe in a simple way, something like an ayahuasca ceremony or a bogus ceremony or something. So this term entheogen came around by a variety of anthropologists and such, including Carl Rupp, and basically was to kind of redefine this. Now, entheogen has meant a variety of things, including some synthetics, but it's kind of now meaning more sort of natural plant-based, mushroom-based type things. You know, there's good arguments for that across the board, but basically it speaks to like, you know, this sort of, or has become to mean, you know, this ancient traditions or people that have worked with these plants and mushrooms and other things in their history. So that's what we use, entheogen versus psychedelic. Again, we're nothing against psychedelic, but that's one of the reasons just to kind of specify these plants and mushrooms. And then another thing too is also I was talking to somebody who's a religious lawyer the other day, and he was talking about, you know, religious freedom in the United States. And saying, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you don't have to go, again, this is, you don't have to ask for permission to be able to practice your religion. As long as you're saying over and over again, hey, this is a sacred practice, that should hold up. You shouldn't have to go beg for your ability to have this right, right? So using this term entheogen sort of gives a second layer of understanding of what this experience is and all these resolutions. I mean, I tell you what, entheogen is kind of those terms that not many people knew. I mean, you know, in the bubble, people knew about it, but now I'm seeing it in policy, hearing newscasters talk about it, like all these ways that this works.
And easier to use it in psychedelics.
In one way, yeah. I mean, so we, in a way, yes, because we don't have to, I'd rather spend 2 minutes to redefine a word than spend 50 years or, you know, spend, you know, hours trying to unpack 50 years of stigma, right? And that automatically comes with psychedelics.
Okay, listen.
And then when we're talking about entheogen, also, you know, oftentimes people do stumble over it, you know, in terms of the word, right? And I have this little theory that it's because they want to say psychedelic. They want to bring all that baggage out, right? And they can't. So they can stumble over the beginning of the word entheogen. So newscasters, you know, city council members, elected officials, et cetera. So it's kind of this fun thing to watch, this reframing of language. Because this is a language game as much as anything else. That's decriminalized nature, entheogen. Why we're choosing, the strategies we're choosing is because we're trying to get rid of the stigma. With so much re-education we are doing around some miseducation that finding the right words, and even if they're not necessarily the best choice, it encourages conversation. And that's what we're really trying to do outside of CSM.
So interesting. So you really consciously chose to focus on the word entheogen versus psychedelic. And perhaps that's something we have to adopt as well. So perhaps
that I hear it could be worthwhile.
I like the both. I like the subject of psychedelic as well. Yeah.
Yeah. Both of them have their value for sure. I mean, I co-founded another nonprofit called Entheogenic Research Integration Education about 10 years before in 2011. And I was actually the one that was the most resistant. So I was like, I watch people stumble over that word all the time. And, you know, it's maybe people don't know what it is. And they're like, well, let's just do this. And I was like, okay, yeah, maybe this would work in order to start something new. It's a new conversation. And actually, I think, you know, we get your typical amount of pushback is with anything. You're going to have pushback around issues, you know. But for the most part, I think it's been really great to be able to redesign things for folks.
Cool.
So you guys are based in Bay Area. So how are you organized within the country, since you have so many states and so many different laws? That seems kind of confusing to organize yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely been quite a task. You know, this is all 5 years. You know, the double-edged sword of the pandemic is that a lot of people, when it started, were like, oh, well, there's too many other priorities to deal with right now. We don't want to deal with this. So that's the downside. But then also you have a lot of people who were like, okay, I had many teams from a bunch of different places be like, this is the only thing that gave me hope over the last however many years, like something to look forward to, something that was positive in the news, something that we kind of like, you know, rally around, right? And so people started using Zoom pretty regularly. So now I'm able to go, and other people are able to go and help out and like sort of, you know, be subject matter experts for, you know, city council members or whatever else, but the opportunity for communication just become regular to do it like this. And I think that helped actually quite a bit. Because if you think about, you know, the pandemic and we still passed all these cities, it's pretty amazing if you think about it. So basically what we do is, you know, we put the word out. Once we came out, we passed in Oakland, social media and such like that, it kind of just exploded. Our model is something that was really easy for people to get, you know, we packaged it up really nice. Here's the template. Here's this, you know, the city council resolution. It's changed the names, you know, it's now been vetted by all these city attorney's offices. You're ready to go. We do consultations, we do orientation meetings, we meet up with city council members, all this kind of thing. And then each of these different groups has a local leadership that gathers their community there. Because at the end of the day, Olympia, Washington, we just passed last week. They're going to know the conversation in Olympia a lot differently than I am here in the Bay Area, or someone in Detroit is going to speak to a different type of community. So to have that local leadership really push forward. And then what also is great about that is it's not us doing it. You know, it's you know, the biggest concern around movements is you have a head figure that all of a sudden that person disappears and the whole thing fizzles. You know, by encouraging and empowering local leadership all over the place, now we have a really strong grassroots-based movement where if anyone falters, someone else can help. There's someone else in that region that can hear, et cetera, et cetera. So that's been really great. So the way that we've been doing it is just kind of like, you know, getting the word out, doing the orientations, you know, having local leaders kind of work things, build things up. And then from there, you know, talk to the city council members. You know, we go city, county, state, obviously federal is a ways away. You know, federal cannabis is still federally illegal. You know, a lot of times people say, oh, well, you know, it's still illegal at the state level what you're doing on the city.
No,
because we focus on the city. And I'm like, yeah, well, cannabis is still legal on the federal level, but you don't see, you know, feds coming in and busting down cannabis shops or anything like that.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, what we're trying to say is like, where are you coming in contact most with local law enforcement? Sometimes people are in county areas, so they're going to have sheriffs. Then that's a county level thing we want to do. But most of the time, somebody's going to be knocking on your door around this issue. It's going to be local law enforcement. And to their credit, while there's been some back and forth and there's been, you know, obviously a shift in perspective that needs to happen a lot of times with police chiefs, almost all of them are willing to work with us, willing to learn more, trying to figure out what's going on, wants to do what's best in the community. And almost all of them are like, trust us, we have better things to do than go after people. And that's even what was said in Olympia, you know? And so I was like, okay, well, if that's the case and you're not really arresting anyone anyway, it's an unspoken rule, then let's make it spoken. Let's just put it in paper and make sure that everyone feels comfortable and safe about this, where we can all work together now instead of feeling like we're kind of putting one over on each other. So I think this is a really important part of that is getting the law enforcement, the police chiefs and things like that on board with that local DNM. And, you know,
will you expand to Europe at a certain point?
We have some teams from Europe. It's a different approach though. That's the, because what we're doing here is a little bit of like a loophole to some degree where it's like, we'd have to say where we can't at a city level change state law. We can't at a city level change federal law. What the power of the city does have is where is the budget going and where are our priorities? And so the city can say, we don't want to put any money in this for our budget. We have other things to do. We don't want to set this as a priority. We have other things to do. So, so that's kind of what we do here locally to make that happen. So you're in and out a little bit here. Am I still?
And then in Europe, it's a different approach because what I know in Amsterdam, close to our house, is a coffee shop, the biggest coffee shop, and it's called the Bulldog. And it's actually an old police station. So when you go in, you have the bars on the left where the people had to register, and then we have cells, and there's actually photos of old police chiefs inside this, and it's kind of a big icon for the city of how we changed and how I think it was the 80s or 70s the government or the local government decided not to criminalize people who smoked weed, right? And then I think they even received letters from other countries, I think it's particularly from Switzerland, of police chiefs asking, are you guys crazy? Are you really not penalizing people who smoke weed and do mushrooms? So it has been quite a shift in Europe.
And is there a difference between the US and Europe in a cultural and in a policy way of how you want to instill change?
Yeah. So, I mean, again, in a policy way, I think that's where, I mean, maybe Amsterdam is different because it sounds like the local government did very similar approach there. In other places like the UK or whatever, it's like, it is about who's funding the law enforcement. So for example, in the UK, law enforcement is nationally funded. So it has to now go through the federal government or what they would call the federal government. So that's just a bigger ask and bigger step. You got to deal with more money. You got to deal with more, all that kind of stuff. It's not as local or community-based. Again, maybe Amsterdam is the place to do this as a model. You know, I'm always asking folks that are in, because we've had folks from Spain, France, UK, you know, Luxembourg, like a whole bunch of places out there looking to see how can we make this happen, right?
The weird cannabis law here in Amsterdam or in the Netherlands in general?
about mycelium is okay or whatever, or the chisels are okay, but not...
Yeah, exactly. Or also with cannabis, that the cannabis, the coffee shops can legally sell it, but they can't produce it. So still, up until right now, it's changing at this very moment. This is the first trials to produce cannabis grown in the Netherlands. But up until this point, all the cannabis being sold in the coffee shop comes from the black market as well. It's being bought behind closed doors and then sold legally to the public. So up until the point it enters the coffee shops, it's illegal, and then it turns legal, and then people can legally buy it and consume it.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah, and you know, I mean, in general, Europe has had some much more progressive policies regarding this. Obviously, Amsterdam is what, you know, us here in the States know about a lot. Spain, I don't think they ever criminalized substances, but there's still some weird stuff going on there. And then I remember I went to go see a Worlds of Consciousness conference in Basel, Switzerland in 2000, I think it was. I actually met Albert Hofmann before he passed, you know, briefly at the Stots, right?
Amazing.
So, so Bobo, when I was there, I went into the head shops there in Switzerland, and someone's like, oh yeah, just go into the head shop and ask for a doof set, which is like a smell set, right? And a smell set is like an incense bag. So you can go and you could buy cannabis as incense, and you're supposed to poke holes in it and throw it in your sock drawer, but everyone smokes it. Or you buy fertilizer, which is mushrooms.
Yeah.
So they were just calling it different things and different use packages. Even here, they have, you know, this whole thing with cannabis seeds. They call them genetic souvenirs, right? Because you're not supposed to plant them, but if you do, but they're genetic souvenirs, are going to hold the genetic package. So there's all these other weird little ways that people have been kind of playing with these ideas to get things out. I don't know what the current model is in terms of Switzerland and all that, but yeah, I mean, I think that's maybe another thing. Now, police chiefs, that's, I think, where there's some interesting, if there are people that are supportive. I know that in the UK, there was one police chief that had said, basically, I'm not going to go after people with cannabis in my area. Right. And so that didn't effectively be criminalized. But the only thing is the next police chief comes in, you got to get them to do the same thing unless you get it written in paper. So you do see some of that happening in the US where a sheriff will say, no, we're not interested, or a district attorney, or, you know, public, attorney would say, no, we're not going to prosecute anymore. So that happened in, Washtenaw County, Michigan, which is a county where Ann Arbor, where the University of Michigan is located. And so, that can happen there. Again, it's just trying to figure out exactly what the pathway is. I know it's possible. It's got to be possible. It's just getting that sort of buy-in from the people who are making those decisions, which is at the end of the day, what we're trying to do, educate those folks. Yes, it's great to have it in policy, but if we can all be in agreement that, hey, we're not going to go after anybody, then I think we're good. Now, of course, please also do some interesting things. It's kind of funny sometimes there's this assumption that, like, if you have mushrooms in your pocket, you're now you can't be tried for anything. You can basically like rob a bank. As long as you have mushrooms in your pocket, you're free. Right. And it's like, okay, well, that's not exactly what we're trying to do. Like, well, you know, we can't have this be a psychedelic free for all where people just put mushrooms on themselves and then go commit crimes and stuff like that. No, that's not what we're asking for. But, you know, all the different ways that they're trying to, like, you know, find a way to like still follow the law, because, you know, their mindset is follow the law. And so it's sometimes a big step for them to be like, okay, well, there's a reason for this. And we've had, you know, law enforcement say, you know, I don't think this is a good idea. And then by the time we're done educating them, be like, okay, hey, things change and maybe this is for the best, you know, and this is across the board. So the education that, and usually it comes with personal testimonies from the local community, you know, so there's certain subject matter experts that ever speak to the issue, perhaps first responders or veterans who kind of want to speak to this issue. And then, you know, they're seeing these testimonies that are just so emotionally heavy, you know, and stories of personal transformation that, it's hard for them to say no. Yeah. You know, I think, you know, if they have anything hurt at all.
Can you share one of those?
Yeah, I mean, I think the one that sticks out, you know, and I've mentioned this in a few other podcasts, one that sticks out the most for me is, you know, when we presented this to the Oakland City Council. This is in 2019. It was the first time we'd even tried. This is different than, you know, or in Oregon or Denver too, because it wasn't like anonymously vote yes or no on a ballot that no one will ever see who you are. This is like cameras in my face. I'm on public record telling the city council I broke the law and you need to change that law. Now that's courageous, especially when we just started this, right? You know, so people coming into Oakland, we like, okay, we had this presentation going. We probably invited 15 to 20 people to come speak. Word got out in the Bay Area. Next thing you know, the line's like 100 people long. Okay, well, if every person gets 2 to 3 minutes to talk, you got a pretty long talk going on here, right? So the city council members are like, all right, you know? So they're like, you guys got to kind of calm it down. Of those like 80 other people that we didn't even know, could have been, you know, 70 of them were against it. I think all of them were for, I think one person was talking about a different issue. So it doesn't really technically count. We got 99 people on the same issue, right? But almost all of them were positive, right? Pass that committee, go to the final committee, right? City council's like, hey guys, we might pass this, but we need to do this before 2 a.m. So, you know, get your people ready to go, you know, keep it succinct. And still there's like 30 people who wanted to share the story because they're so, right? And so one story that I remember in this process was, and it was like, there wasn't a dry eye in the house kind of thing where a woman came up and she was like, hey, you know, these empty gyms really changed my life. About 5 years ago, I was ready to, you know, go through suicide and, you know, I had a heroin addiction and I was having all these problems and I didn't know what to do with my life and I was ready to end it all. Right. And 5 years ago, I had an Ibogaine experience that changed my life. Got me out of all these substance use issues I was having issues with. It got me into a good state of mind. So I wasn't feeling the need to, you know, go through anything to end my life. And here's my 4-year-old daughter. Like everyone in the room was like, whoa, just like, wow. You know, like not only this person shift from like, you know, total despair, but now is like sharing that like now she has someone in her life too that will help her move forward. That wasn't even going to be possible until she made the shift and change from the Ibogaine experience. So that was a really powerful, I think, statement of personal transformation. You hear those in cities all across. We're actually putting together something right now where we're gathering all the personal testimonies from all the different cities, and we're going to try to do little snippets of them because, you know, it's unfortunate get lost in sort of the city council archives and nobody sees, you know, 30, 40 amazing testimonies of people. So we're trying to bring those out and really sort of highlight those in the near future.
Yeah. We also have so many emails, right, of comments of people who said it changed their life. In our case, it's mostly DMT, 5-MeO-DMT. However, it's hard to get them all out or get them all shared also because they're such personal transformative stories, right? But there are so many. Yeah.
Right.
So if I can rephrase what you do, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a grassroots level organization that tries to span across the US and Europe and perhaps even other places where you install local groups of local leaders who have insight and correct information about the subject matter. And they talk with local, small city councils or other influential people to discuss or to put decriminalization up for debate. Is that correct?
Yeah, basically, yeah. We sort of, you know, first step is really to get the local community, start building a little community, start reaching out to the city council members. We have the resolution ready to go. There's on the city level here in the US, there's three different approaches to making change happen on the city level. One is a resolution, one is an ordinance, and one is an initiative. The initiative is expensive. That's a ballot initiative. So that's going to, you know, cost money for each signature. And then you got to do the campaign and da, 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 da. So that's probably the most expensive. And typically the deep pockets are more involved with that one. But once that changes, once that bill's in there, you know, the language is set and it changes municipal code. And there's not really anything a state level thing to do. So that's where Denver could actually make this happen because this is a citizen led initiative. An ordinance is a little bit stronger than a resolution. But still about the same. The ordinance basically changes municipal code. So that becomes a little tricky because that will be in conflict with state law. It takes two readings. It's harder to undo and it's sort of set in stone. What we do is a resolution. A resolution is basically, like I said, setting the priorities, setting where the funding goes, this type of thing. And that's what we sort of give to the folks to bring into the city council. A lot of times they'll want to go, oh, can we be more organized or something else? But that's what we do. So that is presented and ready to go. Once we start talking with city council members, sometimes, you know, I've been surprised. Sometimes it's like city council members have just been like, oh, we've been waiting for you to get here. We can't do this ourselves. But yes, I know I've had these experiences. I know some of them have had an experience, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah,
let's make this happen. That's great because that moves things forward real quickly. Sometimes if you know somebody, that's always going to be helpful. Other times it's just kind of spinning your wheels, trying to get those first conversations. You know, we have just had some really great conversations with some folks in Chicago. Chicago's been a very interesting story too, because we passed it for half a day by an accident, and then COVID happened and shut it down. And the reason being is in Chicago in November 2019, we had it went through the consent count, right? Which is sort of the first thing, like, okay, we consent that we'll talk about these issues. Right. And so somebody on the first day of their job was like inputting stuff into the computer. And so they put adopted instead of consented. And so the next morning I wake up and like Irwin and all these other places are like, Chicago just passed. And we're like, what? Chicago passed? Like, we was a consent calendar. So for like a half the day until they undid it, basically.
Somebody did a mistake in the computer. That's wild. But
right. And so, and that just speaks to this, again, the silliness of the law.
So you must have so much resistance from these people as well, right? And we discussed this already, that psychedelics or entheogens, or you're changing a certain word to make it more acceptable, while psychedelics have had such stigma and such resistance. So you're fighting a very hard battle. Trust me, we also know this battle. We're getting constantly banned. And right now our payment system got banned because they said, oh, you're doing something drug related and you're in the category of firearms, porn, and drugs. And people don't fit. It's absolutely always a battle. And perhaps we can learn from you, like, what are strategies that you use to conquer these hurdles that you're facing?
Yeah, I mean, the hurdles, there's a variety of hurdles, you know. I mean, we've had hurdles from the expected to the unexpected. The expected would be the people who are, you know, drug warriors that have been against these issues forever and have a variety of reasons why they're upset about what's going on. So, for example, you know, people who are just, you know, opposing, you know, we've had somebody in Montana, for example, that was somebody had written papers about how people have died from cannabis overdoses, right? Well, really, where do you get information from, right? So, yeah. So obviously, like, had a particular bias that they're like, oh, that was tough, you know. But we just continue to do the education. We just continue to talk with them. We try and talk with them. There's people, certain people, like you say, that are just sort of against this. A lot of what we do is education, you know. So that shifts things a little bit. It tries to keep us out of the, you know, we could say we're doing risk reduction. You know, risk reduction means that we're trying to reduce the risk for, not that it's harm reduction, which is like, you know, there's inherent harm in there, but we're trying to make the risk better. So doing a lot of education has been really helpful for folks. Bringing in people that they know is helpful, trying to find out ways to be able to speak on the same page. You know, at the end of the day, I think a lot of the folks are, if you can kind of break it down to like, do you think people should be in jail for this? Sometimes that like helps shake people up a little bit, or realize like, oh yeah, wait, okay, maybe there's another way to go about this approach. But you know, we also have hurdles from in community. You know, we had a lot of pushback from, like, for example, the Drug Policy Alliance and the Students for Sensible Drug Policy at any point in time, because we were called quote unquote psychedelic exceptionalists, or not even psychedelic exceptionalists, or nature exceptionalists, if anything, because you're not talking about LSD or things like that, right? So because they want us, their goal is to decriminalize all substances. And now, yes, we're all supportive of that as well. But we didn't have the Portugal of the U.S. that we're hoping, which is that Oregon MO-10 model ended up getting repealed. And there was just, unfortunately, it came at the wrong time. It was right in the middle of a pandemic. People obviously were doing their substances, et cetera, et cetera. So that makes sense that there's going to be, you know, reported higher levels of overdoses and things of that nature. They also, I don't think, really did their treatment programs real well on that one, in terms of like, that would have been great if they had included some of the plants and mushrooms to help with the treatment, that type of thing. So So we having some folks, you know, that are, that we would assume to be allies that were against us because we weren't doing kind of exactly what they were doing, which is like, that's good. That's what makes, you know, things happen in the world. We don't all have to do the exact same thing, right? We often look at that from different angles. So those are a little bit more, I think, emotionally challenging because you're just like, hey, aren't we supposed to be allies? You know, what's going on here? But they have their own agenda. And they've been working on policy for 30 years. And here we come along, a new group, and we pass more policy in more cities than they passed in 30 years. I get that that's something that I'm not too happy about. So some of the hurdles, you know, comes, you know, we can help with the education. Some of the hurdles are more just like, okay, we just got to be more specific of why is what we're doing. We're not like, you know, threatening anybody. We're not trying to like end drug policy by only working on these substances. But at the end of the day, you know, we're talking to city council members. We have to be realistic, you know, city council members, plants and mushrooms are not threatening for folks a lot of times. You start talking about even LSD. Oh, that's that acid stuff. Or, you know, oh, you know, it's not this, you know, heroin, you know, like there's all these other things that they're, you know, with a few exceptions here and there, most city council members are not prepared to go there. And that's who we're trying to convince.
If I talked about it so much professionally or like through decriminalized nature, did you sort of come professional as well in a private setting? Let's say you have to talk about it with like the grandma of your girlfriend or so. Like, I guess you've got to be involved in a lot of conversations about psychedelics just randomly in your private life. Did you formulate like a perfect pitch that you just have ready for people in your surroundings? Or
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something that has sort of evolved over time. And I made this sort of really definite decision a long time ago when I started doing my dissertation, because I wrote my dissertation on ayahuasca archetypes transformation and how to help people with integration. So what's the big, I don't know if this happens in Europe, but at least in the States, like the big question everyone asks is, what do you do for a living? That's like, hey, what's your name? What do you do for a living? How's the weather? You know, that type of thing. Right. So, for a while I was like, oh, psychology or consciousness studies or transpersonal psychology, which is all true as well, because that is kind of the core of what I'm looking at. And these are sort of the tools or the beings that we're interacting with to get to these deeper states. But at some point in time, I was like, oh, I'm kind of tired of tending. You know, I have all these opportunities to practice. It's in the line at the grocery store. It's next to somebody on an airplane. It's, you know, going down the street, just talking to somebody. It's, you know, being in a sauna, somebody sitting next to you, all these different conversations that can come up and people can hear, right? And it's a good opportunity to practice. And I think that's actually helped train me to be able to say, like, who's this? Because the key is there's 20 different ways to explain it to the person in front of you. One or two words. Figure out what those two are, you know? And you got to kind of do this like quick analysis of this person through the conversation as well to say, okay, you know, is it end of life anxiety that they're interested in? Is it religious and spiritual practices? Is it, you know, human rights issues? What is it that we can sort of tap into? And just getting into the habit of practicing that. And that's what we do now with city council members. We do this like little analysis, say, okay, what's the best way we think to approach this and pitch this to the individual? And of course you want some flexibility because you never know what happened. There's an example of one of the city council members in Oakland that we were chatting with. You know, we had kind of the strategy and then strategy didn't look like it was working real well. You know, she was kind of like dismissing. And then the last person that came to talk, was an elder surgeon. And he was dealing with end of life anxiety, you know, and talking about that issue. And all of a sudden, tears started flowing down her face because her husband had just passed. And he's like, she was like, if he had this, this is the thing he needed. This would have been so much better for his end of life if he had just known about this. And so you just don't know what it is, but you start to just sort of like engage in the conversation. Like you're saying, you're doing it professionally when you're not sounding like, yeah, we're just trying to get high, you know, because maybe people are as well, you know, I mean, that's their own right, you know, but at the same time, talking about it, like how they can be beneficial and not really, we're trying really to avoid, especially now after the FDA and MAPS thing and all that stuff's going on, we're trying to avoid leaning too heavily on science and clinical data because, you know, these experiences can't really be described or even measured sometimes in these paradigms, right? So to really just find ways to speak to the person that taps into, yes, there's some clinical data here. Yes, there's some science behind it, but hey, look at, you know, 30 million people doing this safely. I think the RAND report said 8 million people did mushrooms last year or something like that, right? In the United States, right? Which is like, that's a lot of people, you know, that's a good percentage of, you know, the US population. And that's just in 1 year, you know? So we're probably looking at 30, 50, 60 million people have tried psychedelics in the United States. So, and I think that was something in cannabis world that was really important. So the whole quote unquote coming out of the closet part was great, or is important, you know, because it wasn't about does the person smoke cannabis or ingest cannabis that makes them positive around policy. It's do they know somebody that does? And that breaks the stigma down. Oh, this isn't this bad person that I've heard about on the news. This is my friend that smokes a joint here and there, or this is my friend who does mushrooms for microdosing, or who does has this big experience and doesn't have any experiences for a while because we're working on it, you know, all these different things. So just like having people come out of the closet, having people share, having people do, you know, what I do, talk to people randomly here and there in these very informal settings. That's all kind of this ripple that we're trying to sort of engage in, and having all these different teams all over the place, and we kind of can work news cycles too. So whereas we have like a, you know, a news cycle in the Bay Area is never going to hit, you know, maybe Detroit or maybe Florida or Atlanta, Georgia, but you have something there that happens and boom, that news then ripples out. You know, so we're kind of like, it's like dropping stones in these ponds and watching the ripples
in all
the territories. Yeah. So.
Cool. And you make a good point that it's not just about research or about therapeutics. Sure, people have benefited from mushrooms with end of life projects, or they have issues with clinical depression or with PTSD. But I have the impression that you do it for the broader sense of just being free, right? Free to consume plants, whether or not you do it for spiritual reasons or for medical reasons. Is there a boundary somewhere? Do you categorize this? Like, what should be the purpose? Or is it just, no, everybody should just be free to do this?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm definitely enough free to do this thing because, again, what we're really trying to do is remove the criminal penalties. You know, like, yes, of course, I have my own biases of like, this model works well for me, or I like this, or no, I couldn't possibly go into a doctor's office and drool on the floor while he takes notes. You know, that's not going to work for me, you know, but maybe for other people, great, no problem. Go ahead and do it. You know, there are some concerns around, you know, hyper suggestibility and all the other ethics that can come into those other types of models as well, you know, but at the end of the day, I think, you know, just making sure that people can have access, because again, at the core of mental health, it's about what is consciousness, you know, at the core of like what we're doing, these experiences, you know, I never heard anyone come into an integration circle where they're sharing about their experiences and say, oh, my frontal lobe was really lit up last night. It was amazing. Right. Or you know, my serotonin receptors were off, right. They were just thrown off last night. Right. No, what they're saying is like, I had this really deep inner experience where I was able to connect to these ancestors of these entities, or I understood consciousness in a different way, or all the types of things that you can kind of go through. And so that's the qualitative nature is really what people are speaking to. So, so I think it's important to really highlight all of that. And unfortunately in the clinical models, you know, it's only highlighted as a periphery, versus it being something that's sort of primary, you know, oh, this helps with depression, but why does it help with depression? Oh, people are going through these experiences. You see that if you read the further down data. But that's not what the sort of the primary goal of the research is, because the money's in the depression, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So do you see it, decriminalization also influencing, you know, how we understand our minds and the evolution of human consciousness and these deeper aspects? Is that part of your work as well?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's my personal work is very much so that, you know, that's what I did a dissertation looking at. You know, that's why I do a lot of integration circles and things of that nature. I think there's certain communities that are right on point with this, probably your super psychonaut community, you know, other communities like, I don't know if you know, the Kalindi community out of Detroit, who's doing high dose mushroom experiences. You know, there are people that are exploring these realms, if you will, you know, indigenous cultures, these realms, as beings. They're not just archetypes or imaginary sort of spaces that they exist. They're real, they have agency, you know, that type of thing. So what happens if that's the case? Wow, that changes a lot of things. You know, there's this idea of the Copernican revolution, right? Where everything revolves around the sun, or the earth, I should say, right? And then the Copernican revolution, oh, actually the earth is revolving around the sun, is revolving around blah, blah, blah. We're also in the same place with consciousness. We think consciousness revolves around the earth, or human beings, basically. Like, what happens if it's true that there are other beings out there, or these plants have agency? You know, again, we don't know the answer. It's definitely, I've had enough experiences, and it's odd that I don't have experiences where it's like, oh yeah, I had a really strong DMT experience and I was just laying on my couch. I was like, no, I went to this place. You know, I saw these beings, like I had a conversation with them. It seemed like wisdom beyond anything that I have ever thought of in my life. Like, what is that? Where is that coming from? Is consciousness really that profound? Is there other areas of consciousness? So folks like, for example, in the Detroit community, they've been doing sort of these higher doses. Again, you know, I can speak to your and sort of crew about this, the super psychonauts, but you know, obviously this isn't something that I think most people are you know, prepared for. He did a lot of whole classes around, martial arts and sort of like a little bit of structure to his journeys. But he would say, you know, this is how ancient texts were supposed to be read. You know, we're reading them with our 2D eyes. You know, we're supposed to go and read hieroglyphics, for example, through these psychedelic experiences, you know. So, and it comes from African traditions and things like that. So we've explored a lot of that, kind of dynamics. So what does that mean? You know, what if there's a whole bunch of texts out there that are just waiting for us to open our eyes, quote unquote, meaning read them through these other experiences? You know, there's a whole possibility. And again, we don't know. We haven't really explored that. And science, there's no money for the science in that. The science is only around mental health issues right now. But that's what I think is really going to be exciting, is like, what is consciousness? Where is consciousness? How is consciousness? What is the nature of reality? Is consciousness primary? What does that mean around the material world? How do we measure it? Is there a way to measure it? All that kind of stuff, you know? And even, you know, to the more sort of sketchy side of things, which I had saw a really great talk in Berkeley, a guy named Lenny gave this talk. He was worried about the sort of, he called it the colonization of the astral plane. He was saying, like, what does it mean when some of our ambassadors, for example, you probably heard some of the long-term, and he was kind of referencing this, and again, I haven't looked into the specifics of this, the long-term DMT states where people can, like, you know, explore around in there. Sometimes it's military folks that are doing that, right? It's like, so if these worlds are real and these places and these beings are actually interactable, right, then these are our ambassadors, which have a different mindset of like, hey, let's all connect, but like more like helping colonize this area and like make it ready for the next version. Yeah. So it's like interesting. Again, we don't know the answers to all these questions, you know? And so I think start to explore that, to start to sort of tap into consciousness as a thing outside of just neuroscience is really important. We're sort of stuck in this neuroscience about, oh, great. Yeah, exactly. Okay, great. We have these things lit up in the brains, but like, what does that mean? So,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure if you're
on next stage. Yeah, it's time. How do you get to this point? It's like, what do you reckon? Like, coming from psychedelics having such an important role in ancient cultures, how do we move to a society where they're so criminalized? And how do we get to a point that you have to do all of this work just to get them back into mainstream society?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's like the somehow, and I don't know. There are certain appropriate altered states of consciousness, and there are certain feared altered states of consciousness. Why are there certain altered states of consciousness that are feared? I'm not sure. Does it upends the current paradigm and worldview? Maybe that's what it is, and that's too unsettling for folks, possibly. But I think that, you know, at the end of the day, that's what we need to do. And the only way to really do that is even like, you know, you see like a lot of people talking about, and again, the thing is people that are doing microdosing, but you're not getting. If you microdose for 10 years, you'll never know what a psychedelic is, So to really be able to sort of tap into these deeper experiences, be able to hold space for folks. And that's where the integration comes in. That's just the other work I do in terms of the post experience, you know, to get people talking about the integration circles that we were running for the last decade. Like, so powerful to see somebody sitting in a space. And it's always weird to get a lot of people that have the same theme. They come in on the night and they're all wanting to talk about something in a similar theme, but when they see somebody else is also having a similar experience, we're so isolated in our weird experiences that, like, who do we talk to about? And when we realize like other people have also had it now, okay, wait, maybe there's some themes here. Maybe this isn't just me alone. This isn't just some random dream, but this is something that maybe other people are also tapping into. This is really fascinating. So to be able to find ways to be able to talk about their inner experience, I think is really, really critical to really be able to share that it's not just something that, and we're all still trying to figure it out. There's no like the definitive answer yet. But I think in general, as we move forward, that's going to be the more people that are having those bigger experiences, the more that conversation is going to start happening. And I think, it's already happening. It's just, we're still stuck in this, so to speak. Right. Yeah.
Where is the current status? Because we're the science psychedelic renaissance is well on its way, and I saw you guys on Netflix in episode 4 of Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind, or is that the show?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's amazing. But can you give a small snapshot of where we are, and perhaps also why we are here? Because
you know, a question that keeps, it's a controversial question, but it's like, is there an overlord scheme to keep us from evolving, to keep us dumb and keep psychedelics down? Or is it just that people are not educated? Or how did we get here, and where are we right now? Are we on the brink of revolution still, or is it slowly dying, and why?
Mm-hmm. Jeez,
real quickly, in one sentence,
please.
So I think there is, I speak to some friends of mine who are in the medical community, and I try and have some of this conversation, and they oftentimes are very invested in what they've done. And so they take things very defensively, you know, in terms of like, oh, okay, well, you know, when I say, hey, there's this system in place that we're all participating in, it's not you as a medical practitioner, but it's a system which is based upon, oh, you got to go into the stock market. Oh, if the stock market means you profit at all costs, well, it means you're going to cut corners, which means you got to do this, which means you got to do this, this regulation, this, you know, synthesis, this thing, da 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 da. And next thing you know, the system has boiled you down to this thing that's super controlled to make, you know, and so, and again, people do their thing. That's great and all. But when you start doing that, then you sort of getting out of like experiences for experiencing. Right. So I wouldn't say necessarily that there's a, you know, obviously there are people, I think, that a lot of these insights from these experiences are, how do we live life differently? If we come from a place of source, do we really need to be buying things? There's a lot of people who might say that perhaps this is bad for a capitalist system because we don't need to prove ourselves by buying the next brand new car. We can just say, well, I had a big experience last night and you feel pretty great on that, you know?
Yeah. I mean,
so those types of things.
Substances do dissolve power structures and models, right? It dissolves our model, and the people around us, the society wants us to play within the model, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. So in terms of that comes, if we can do more education, that should at least help for people that are sort of open to the idea. Are we on the brink of revolution, or are things dying? I think, but we're always on the brink of revolution. That's the joke, right? That's the cosmic joke, right? Just out of reach. No, but as this sort of movement keeps going forward, again, you know, that's why we're trying to say empower the individuals. So even if the narrative is controlled, even if, you know, the way to do it is controlled, or it's going to cost you $20,000 to have an experience, but you can go pick mushrooms out of the ground, whatever, you know, like I think in Australia, their medicalized psilocybin models like $16,000 or $20,000 Australian, you know, to do that, you know, for these synthetic versions, right? So that type of stuff is happening. But as long as we can continue to have people growing and sharing and connecting with each other and doing these deep experiences, you know, to not make that microdosing is the only way. Yes, that's great that it's the case, but to let people know that there's more, so they don't just get stuck in the like, oh, I'm bored with this and there wasn't anything special there. I don't know what everyone's talking about. Because it is going to be a revolution of the mind. And to get people to think about things in kind of a different way, I think is important. Now, you know, you have a lot of people who say, oh, these are non-specific amplifiers. So it's not necessarily, you know, I have my ayahuasca mentor says, you know, narcissism is probably the worst thing possible to try and work with in these, you know, experiences, because somebody has a death and rebirth experience and all of a sudden they're like, oh, that's great. I survived it. And then the ego inflation happens even more. So you know, that's not necessarily a positive in terms of like, you know, a revolutionary state of mind, you know, but I think it does shake up paradigms. It does shake up, you know, status quo structures and stickiness, you know, it sort of forces you to do that. And now it's like, can we as a human population understand how to work with ourselves in such a good way? Are we so stuck in the system that pulling out is going to be a break? Or can we easily sort of dissolve that, as you're saying, into some new thing that allows us to still be figuring out how to get out of the system we're currently in that isn't really healthy for a lot of folks, while at the same time allowing us to explore new ideas, brainstorm new you know, approaches to life and all that. So that's a good question. I don't know if we're where we're at in that process. I'd like to say that we're getting closer towards, you know, moving things forward in a revolutionary way. You know, even just reading something, I read something in the Rolling Stones the other day, again, has its own biases because it still puts it in a gatekeeping model of these sort of religious structures, but saying like, oh, medical, something like, you know, I went to see medicalization and I found God or something like that, right? So people are like, you know, having to expand, like, what is, even that is interesting in a positivist worldview, which is like, you know, it's only exists if it's measurable mindset, or reductionist worldview, where everything is just very easy to sort of, you know, put in our hands, so to speak, right? But when we're talking about these abstract consciousness experiences, that's going to sort of blow people's minds open in a big way, and not force us to have to be stuck into that system. So that's what we're pushing for, you know, hopefully. And of course, I think that there's always the response we hear to something like that is like, oh, we don't want a Timothy Leary this thing and blah, blah, blah. And like everyone blames Timothy Leary. And it's like, why doesn't anyone blame Nixon? Everyone's talking about Timothy Leary, and was the guy who criminalized things. So anyway.
What do you think will happen to the world if it got more decriminalized?
Would decriminalized nature still be in place? Would it still exist?
Yeah, I mean, if it's been decriminalized all across the world, or descheduled, I guess, at that point in time, hopefully that would be the case, then yeah, we would, you know, oftentimes when we're in our different level, city level stuff, we tell the folks to build an educational organization for after, you know, plant libraries. I'd like to see, you know, farmers markets. I would like to see places where people can consume together. That's maybe like it's open all night, yeah, and it's, you know, different rooms doing different things. You can kind of go there and have a safe space to have these experiences with other people in community. Lots of education, lots of community gardens, you know, like it's so interesting with the cannabis stuff that happened, whereas like part of the policy was like, you can only grow it in private, you can't have it in public view. And it's like, these are beautiful flowers and things of nature. Like, why aren't we saying like, hey, look at how beautiful these flowers are, and look at how beautiful these plants are. What is our, you know, and that'll help us also reconnect to like, oh yeah, we're destroying the planet, you know, we're messing things up over here. So, so I think that's a lot of what we are looking at is like sort of the follow-up would be, you know, community-based exchanges. We're not against, you know, any kind of like trade or exchange or, you know, that type of thing. It just puts us in a different model. Once it's legalized, you got to get a business license and taxes and da 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 da. So trying to find ways to keep it sort of community-based and grassroots as long as possible, and let it kind of emerge as it's already doing. That would be kind of a goal for me, or I would hope to see. And you know, we're trying to put even together a little school out here, a school not for training people how to sit for somebody, because that's like 2% of the people having these experiences, but 98% of people are like, what just happened? And that's what we'd like to sort of tap into, you know?
Could you in some way also see this whole thing going out of hand and just going into a negative direction? Let's say everything is fully legalized, decriminalized.
I mean, as of 50 years ago, there was no laws against a lot of these things, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, the 60s and 70s, you could say it went out of hand or what have you, but everyone's still surrounding us. You know, we see those people are in positions of power currently. So maybe it goes out of hand 30 years down the road or something like that. But I think there's always that possibility, but I think that's why we're trying to do this in a good way. That's why we talk about this, like be intentional, be sacred about it, be responsible about it, you know, make sure you're safe, make sure you talk to other people who know what's going on. Right. Everyone's had a difficult, challenging experience here and there, to have some people to talk to afterwards about it, you know, that can be really helpful. And you know, I mean, a lot of times people are like, okay, that wasn't for me and I'm not going to do it anymore. Okay. Well, you know, it's not like we're shoving this down everyone's throat. And I think that to me would be the bigger challenge is you hear a lot of these sort of pharma companies who are like, oh, we have 300 million people across the world that suffer from depression. We're going to give everybody psychedelic. I'm not sure if that's the best idea, you know, because I've had experiences where I become more depressed afterwards. I realized like, wow, how beautiful everything could be. And here we are back in this world where maybe people don't care so much. And so, so that can be very depressive. So, you know, we'll try to find situations where it's an organic emergence versus like, you know, sort of forcing everyone into it, or finding it as like, this is the cure for this thing and that people are dependent upon it. And all of a sudden it doesn't cure them the way they hoped it had. And now they're even more depressed as well. These different types of things can happen. So that could also be a problem. And we also heard that a lot in terms of like when we were getting some pushback in the beginning, you know, if you guys decrim, this is going to be bad for the FDA trials. I was like, actually, the problem with these FDA trials is you got a microscope on what's going on, and anything happens there, it's going to mess us up for decrim. And now here we are, decrim, you know, has been moving along, you know, pretty well. Now the FDA trials have failed. And now everyone's like, you know, we're hearing from city council members, oh, we heard the psychedelic trials didn't work, blah, blah, blah. What's going on? Actually, it was MDMA. It's something different. Da, da, da. We have to kind of explain all that. But yeah, you know, I mean, even that kind of dynamic shakes out in terms of like, where is the locus of action?
Yeah.
And maybe if we can kind of shift that locus of action back into the grassroots, then maybe we won't have as big of a concern, because again, you do have to worry about hypersuggestibility. You do have to worry about the fact that I heard a senator in Kentucky say that, oh, what we're going to use Ibogaine for is to make soldiers more ready and more lethal. Like, wait, what?
Yeah.
That's not what anyone's ever told me about regarding this type of thing, you know? And so when we had this veteran conversation, we had a couple about war stuff, because we talked about people saying like, oh, we're going to put this on the front lines of Ukraine so that people could be more soldier ready. You know, that's where it can go. Or you have DARPA who's saying like, hey, let's try and remove the psychedelic side effects and just have this be this thing. Now, I'll tell you, that could be good for maybe people with like neuroregenerative stuff or Alzheimer's or those different types of things. You don't want to give them a big experience. But their idea is like, this is a side effect versus it being the primary function, you know?
So exactly.
There's a lot of ways these could go, but hopefully we're going to continue with podcasts like yours and people doing good work all across the place, you know, all across the world. Hopefully we'll be able to sort of right the ship, so to speak.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, you could really see this going into a weird direction, new psychedelics being born, and then also all of this evolving in a space next to the evolution of AI and virtual reality. Right. And
AI is talking about
how do you see things go together? Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. The AI and psychedelics is interesting because, you know, I think they are using AI to like come up with new compounds. On a very rudimentary level, I do like to sort of ask some of the AI, like, all right, if I was to make a psychedelic for you, how would I make it? Because it speaks to a lot of different levels of consciousness there. Like, what is it? How is it thinking about that? You know? And so, of course, it's all censored. So it's like, psychedelics are a leak.
But it could. It could create some crazy things.
Yeah, totally. So that's definitely, you know, I mean, and again, interesting time that all this is happening, because again, you're speaking about consciousness at the bottom of this. And whether it's psychedelics, what is consciousness or psychedelics, or how is AI viewing consciousness? You know, we are sort of playing in this same sort of realm. So I think we're at this really interesting breakthrough. You know, even the hard problem of consciousness, which I'm sure you probably both know about, is the state of Chalmers theory that you can't, no matter how far down you go, you can't find this moment of consciousness. And then you have Stuart Hameroff, who a while ago was talking about microtubules, and now that's kind of getting a little bit more play again, you know, this microtubule idea. There's sort of this shift in phases or something that happens on these microtubules at a rate of 100,000 per microsecond or something like that, that becomes like a conscious moment, et cetera. So now again, people are starting to think, okay, wait, maybe we can start tapping back into this consciousness conversation instead of just neuroscience. And I think that's going to be really, really fascinating. And I think that will help change a lot of things. Yeah.
What are you most excited about? Is this project? You have another project on the side? What has your focus?
Yeah, I have a lot. I mean, this is kind of my main project right now. Definitely takes up a lot of time and energy and meet so many people from all over the place. But yeah, I think, I'd never worked with policy before 2018, 2019. You know, I was doing academic stuff, neuroscience as an undergrad, you know, qualitative research as a graduate, as my PhD, looking at ayahuasca archetypes trends. So I was very interested in the consciousness, the experience, the inner experience, the phenomenology, all that kind of stuff. So going into policy was kind of like, okay, well, you know, I'm good at explaining things to people, so this should work. And then I just kind of kept moving. But my love, my desire, my interests lay within what is the nature of reality and consciousness. So that's where I was, you know, talking about what we're working on, trying to hopefully get the space together. We don't know yet if it's work out, but if we can get the space together, do some sort of educational thing where we're actually helping people, you know, learn about things and teach them about consciousness and hear from them, and maybe even do sort of citizen science, you know, where people are actually sort of tapping into like, what are these inner experiences, and kind of find a different way to go about the science of psychedelics without it being clinically oriented.
And what's this called?
The space, we are working on it, called Nexus right now, but we don't have a current name. That's a temporary name. Who knows if that'll make it through the gauntlet, but that'll be in Oakland if it works out. We should know probably hopefully within the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, cool. So this is an example of what I was hinting at, right? Like, what is a world where we're not just focusing on making money, but, you know, on making ourselves better and planetless. And it's like, we have more time to actually delve into consciousness, right? Without like an actual like financial incentive. Like, isn't that the biggest question of our reality? Like, right? Like, what are we supposed to do here? Who are we? What are we? I really hope that your movement contributes a little bit, you know, to this
yeah, overcoming this hurdle that people have for using these compounds that actually just let us explore who the fuck we are, right?
Right.
It's exactly. The most important question.
Who on earth is this?
What is this?
I think this is about the next stage that maybe we can start thinking about is like, you know, whether it's tapping into an Arrowhead template or something else, how do we as super psychonauts start to actually like figure out how do we describe this to each other? Because we have to create language, you know, there's this whole idea of effing the ineffable. Oh, we can't talk about it, it's ineffable. Well, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. You know, if you look at some of the Tibetan, you know, texts and things like that, they spend a lot of time to get to that nugget. Maybe it's an invisible nut or it's an invisible nugget. What's really inside, you can't really put any words to it, but you can get close to try and describe it, right? And so that's what we, I think, as deep explorers need to start doing is really get our language on point so that we can start to describe it to each other and we can start passing information to each other that's understandable in a way that we can then start getting a map. I don't want to say like a cartography of the psyche, but that's like I think a Brofian term that is used, or other people have used it as well.
Challenging.
But this map of consciousness, you know, and if we could start getting language down, however that might look, I think that's really key. So that's where something that each of us can kind of start working on that individually when after our own experiences, start jotting things down, start getting these words out there, start figuring out how to. That's what's great about integration circles. You see people will take a word here and a word here and they're testing it out for the first time. It's not this, it's not this, it's this. Does that land with folks? Okay, it does, you know? And that's what we're trying to do too, is try to create that language.
Cool. Yeah, that's what we love a lot about DMT, right? That the language is easier than with other psychedelics. Now, I saw on your website, you focus on several plant medicine or entheogens. DMT wasn't necessarily in there. But people do like it because it's very specific. You know, this term like, okay, there's a waiting room, there's the jester, there's these entities, there's 5D, whatever that means. But jester's explaining 5D after you go through the waiting room, right? And then you have a breakthrough. It's very clear with all this terminology.
It's from a visual perspective, it's pretty easy to explain.
Yeah, and then people have the same or similar, very similar trips. In other psychedelics, perhaps LSD or ayahuasca, it might be more personal and might be more difficult to talk about this. But yeah, that
that's
probably about DMT, right?
Yeah, and I would say that, you know, we're definitely all for DMT. I think that we in the original resolution, the footnote we had to describe entheogens were plants, mushrooms, and natural materials that have tryptamines, phenethylamines, or enolamines. So that would include also all different types of tryptamines, all different, you know, DMTs included. We spoke about ayahuasca because that was an easier thing for people to understand than DMT. Also, we tried to focus more on kitchen level chemistry. And with DMT, you can do that definitely, but there's, you know, there's more of the synthetic version. And we just didn't kind of, and it's happening or whatever. But you know, we want to make this as less threatening as possible to folks. So we spoke to a different type of extraction, DMT, which is an ayahuasca extraction, if you will, the MAOI. So we're definitely for DMT in terms of the part of our thing, but it's not something that we necessarily, you know, I think ayahuasca looks better than little yellow crystals, unfortunately. Hey.
About the communication.
I mean, ayahuasca itself doesn't look very...
Yeah, that's true too. And it certainly doesn't taste very good.
Man, so you are mostly reliable on donations, right? It's all volunteers and donations.
Volunteer donations. We have some merch as well. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You can find us at decriminalizednature.org. That's where our website is. We also have social media accounts on Instagram and Facebook. We're at decriminalizednature. On Twitter or X, we're at decrimnature. So that's where to find us. We're also on LinkedIn, things like that, which surprisingly weird psychedelic place. I didn't expect that. What happened is LinkedIn all of a sudden people are talking to psychedelics everywhere. Used to be like, oh, you don't want to touch on your psychedelic stuff. This is a business thing. Now it's like everyone's talking about it. It's like kind of weird. But so we haven't really dove into that fully, but I do enjoy reading some people's synopsis here and there. But those are a way to contact us. You know, email us, you know, if you're in the States and you want to sort of make policy happen. We really want to help you out. We do an orientation on the last Tuesday of every month. You know, we've probably given orientation to about 70 different teams this year already. So again, this is an election year. It makes it a little bit tricky. I think people are a little hesitant around election time to be jumping in fully on this, but we're doing all this real legwork to start talking to them. We expect 2025 to be pretty amazing. We passed two so far this year. Ypsilanti at the beginning of the year and Olympia just recently. There might be one or two more Washington state cities that are passable for the end of the year and maybe someplace in Montana. What we're really interested in is getting in places that are sort of little deserts, if you will. So like, you know, Georgia or Northwest Arkansas or Alabama or Mississippi, places you wouldn't necessarily expect to be having this conversation to have the conversation. I think really shifts the dynamic because a lot of detractors will say, oh, this is just happening in college towns, blah, 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 blah. But actually the conversation is happening in a lot of different places. It's just always using it to get through certain city council members. So it's really great to see how this movement is growing. And like I say, all over the place, you know, globally as well. So so be happy to help out however we can. But if they have any financial contributions to help us with our project, of course, that's always great. I really appreciate you offering some support as well in this beautiful project they have going.
Of course,
if the, it's so important. It's hard to put it into words how important it is. It's really, we're really grateful for what you're doing.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and it's like the logical small hurdle to overcome is just decriminalizing. And I know the world has a long way to go, especially in Africa and in Asia. You know, perhaps there's somebody from Japan now listening, and they're like, "Oh, what the hell am I gonna do?"
But, you know, maybe it's worth to either donate to Decriminature or perhaps send out an email and see, you know, if you can start something in your area, because this is a global movement. And I think it's extremely important to first not penalize exploring consciousness and what life is all about, because that is an impeccably important part of human nature itself. It's just discovering who we are.
Absolutely. And I think also we're really tapping into the U.S. because I think part of why the world is in this really bad drug policy approach is because of U.S. influence.
You should use that.
So if we can start, yeah, exactly. It's us. We're trying our best. We're trying to fix it, everybody. So helping us out here, I think, you know, that's why we have people coming from Europe to ask us, hey, how do we do this here? We had, you know, somebody from Russia downloading, you know, graphics packages. We have people from, say, Chile's that reached out to want to do some art for us. So this is becoming a global conversation in many, many different ways. You know, lots of people in South and Central America as well. So the more we can get the conversation going here, I think that just keeps the narrative. And that's what's beautiful about these city level approaches too. You know, it takes a while for a state to kick in. It takes a really long time for the feds to kick in, but we can do two or three cities every year. Or, you know, one year we had eight cities, I think, that passed. I think that was the best one we did. So, I mean, that's like once every couple of months. So it's just constantly getting hit with people like, yeah, oh, wait, or another news story. Oh, wow, people are changing their minds about this, right? So the more we can do here, the more it'll kind of ripple out and help everyone.
Well, I applaud what you guys are doing and keep up the incredible, important work. It's
thank you very much.
Absolutely important. And I love
we're following every step of that.
Yeah.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. Right.
And now, as of now, we're going to donate a small percentage of all the products that we sent to this movement. Although, you know, it's in the US largely, I still think it's incredibly important. So, yeah, again, thank you so much. And
thank you so much.
We'll surely also put everything on the website, how people can donate. But it's decriminalizednature.org, was it?
Yep, decriminalizednature.org. Yep.
Okay.
And we're going to be going through a little bit of a website design shift in the near future, hopefully within the next couple of weeks. But I'm not sure. Is this coming out, this podcast coming out soonish or maybe a minute? Or
we don't know yet. That's always the use
back. Okay, so you might have a new website, but it'll still be at the same decriminalization head of URL.
That's fine. But the video on there is pretty cool. I like it.
That was done by the Steiner brothers. Yeah, by a gentleman he was out of Southern California. He's in Georgia now. Does really beautiful work. Did also, if you go on our Instagram or YouTube page, he also did this really great piece about limits. For some reason, there is this push for limitation. We're really, really strongly against limits, being like, okay, well, at 1 ounce, you're okay, but 1 ounce and 1 gram, you're now a criminal or a felon.
Yeah.
Right. And so we're trying to say, hey, there's no reason to have the cops be like, when can I arrest you now? So we did this whole little piece around sort of limitations, especially when it comes to nature. You know, I can have 10,000 tons of poisonous mushrooms in my basement and no one's going to say a thing about it, right? But if I have 1.1 gram over a mushroom, then also I'm in trouble. So, yeah.
You're on.
That's a good point, actually. Limitations, yes or no.
And on the city level, no one's asked. You know, it's mostly been state level and federal level where the sort of the corporate interests come into play.
Yeah. Like with psychedelics, it's such a thing, you know, like you can take, you know, 10 grams of mushrooms. So probably you just, you know, beam as, you know, you're just feeling like God for hours. And then you're probably like, let's not do that for half a year.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. But even like, you know, I mean, like people grow if they're growing their own, like, you know, it's like now you're getting penalized for abundance, right? Nature wants to be abundant and we're saying,
No, when is it enough to arrest you?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Thank you for listening. Go to decriminalizenature.org and purchasesupplies.com. Use the code podcast for a big discount on our beautiful psychedelics stash cases that have all you need for certain psychedelics to use them more safely and educate yourself. Part of our proceeds will continue to go to decriminalizenature.org. Always stay safe, do proper research. Don't take psychedelics on a whim, don't mix them, and follow your local laws. Thank you so much for listening.